Make It Right, the Manufacturing Podcast.
Manufacturing is going through another transformation with Industry 4.0, artificial intelligence, and blockchain all bringing a focus on better, faster, cheaper, and less waste. This week on the Make It Right podcast, we're going to shift focus and talk with Dr. Adam Milofsky, whose life focuses upon materials and manufacturing trends and opportunity identification followed by evaluation, assessment, and finally, looking at where logical venture creation through to commercialization can happen. Adam is a 25-year veteran of the performance chemicals, polymers, and materials industry, and he's held numerous leadership positions in a variety of startup opportunities, both private and within corporate America. He's known for identifying white space opportunities and then employing practical, high-speed, value-oriented development strategies that frequently allow for the successful commercialization of new technology platforms, not simply evolutionary improvements. With 10-plus ventures both independently and within corporate worlds, completed or in progress, and dozens of new materials and manufacturing products and methods commercialized, Adam thoroughly enjoys it when someone says, it's impossible, and then he proves that it is indeed possible. Adam is the CEO or the managing director at Elements, and he's going to talk to us about what I think sounds like some pretty heady stuff, but he says all of this has been proven and can be done. So welcome to the show, Adam.
Hi, that was a long one. Hi, I'm just a guy.
I hope you didn't walk away and come back.
No. I always have to say, my wife should hear that, you know, but anyway.
There you go.
Happy to be here.
I'm glad to have you here because I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation talking about things I don't think we've likely ever discussed on the Make It Right podcast before. So can you explain how open innovation, adaptive innovation, and transformational innovation differ, and then how they all link together?
Sure. I mean, I look at open innovation, and I think innovation as a buzzword has been used, abused, thrown in the garbage, pulled out again, stretched, you know, painted different colors. And when someone starts to telling me about their innovative hamburger, I start to get really disappointed in the world. open innovation for us is really like the wanted pages, right? I mean, it's like, hey, look, I've got a piece of an engine. I got an old lawnmower. I got a new lawnmower. I've got stuff. Hey, does anyone want to try to use this? Right? More often than not, if you look at places like get2.com or Nine Sigma and others, you're really talking about, hey, you know, here's this technology we developed, a lot of times university, and they're describing it accordingly, right? And so it's really hard to discern what's useful, but open innovation can be helpful if you kind of have an idea of what you're looking for. And it's really a whole separate subject, how to improve or change that. Adaptive innovation and transformational innovation. I've been using the term transformational more and more and less of it about adaptive, but they're really kind of the same. I suppose if there was a difference, if I'm trying to transform an industry, you know, obviously there's the literal definition. I'm trying to transform the way things are done fundamentally in that industry. So for example, not that it's really come to fruition even remotely yet, but 3D printing. Right, versus conventional injection molding and manufacturing, right? They're really two kind of really different things. The transformation that's going on there is significant. We'll wait to see if it's truly globally transformational. Maybe a better one to talk about is the horse and buggy converting to the automobile, converting to an airplane, right? That's transformational. Mm-hmm. If I go back to the horse and buggy, I am going to trains. Without trains, the United States doesn't expand across the continent. You know, Europe doesn't so easily connect to Asia back in the 1800s, and suddenly people from all over the planet are able to get together, right? You go to aerospace planes, and wow, we can get together in hours, right? That's transformational versus riding a horse forever and, you know, getting on a boat and then getting back on the horse again. Adaptive innovation, where Steve Levin and I came up with adaptive innovation, and Steve's a colleague I've been working with for 15 years developing a lot of this. It's really about adapting to your surroundings. Too often people want to have this prescription for how to innovate. You know, read this book, here's 25 million kinds of innovation, just follow these 12 easy steps. That's not really how things are done, so to speak. When we look at adaptive, what we find is that through history, through time, but also through pairs of people, 3 different people, 100 different people, from moment in time to moment in time, the way you need to interact, talk, walk, do all the things you do changes. And so for us, adaptive innovation is about conducting or reaching to transformation by understanding that everyone's different. Every company is different. Every organization is different. Every pair of people is different. And so it's important to really talk about innovation surrounded by principles of innovating, and then to worry about all the appropriate tools, methods, approaches that one might use, the 25 million kinds of innovation maybe, based upon what that particular group of folks finds to be the best way to work for them. So as opposed to prescribing and saying, this is how it's done, it's better to say, look, different groups of people can figure out what's best for them. And that's adaptive. Does that make sense?
Yeah, actually, that makes it super clear. So then how are you measuring results on that?
You know, I always love when people talk about measuring results, right? They measure patents, or they measure, you know, all these little things, how many things went through some filtered process or some stage gate thing or God knows what. And we sit there and see, there's only really one measure of successful innovation. And it's really, are you making any money? That's really it. If I go to a venture capital group and they're starting ventures, did they exit? Did they make money? Do we have revenue? Or are we doing it profitably? Do we have large margins? Are we transforming the way people live, essentially, in the end? So if it's a company, they're trying to make money. They're cutting costs, enhancing revenue, enhancing margins. If it's a person, we get a little simpler. And we think it actually applies to companies. And that's the nature of time. What do we all wish had we had more of? Either more time, or better quality time, or both. And when you look at an innovation, if you don't find yourself somehow improving the nature of time, more often than not by a pretty good order of magnitude, you're not innovating. You may want to say you're innovating, and it may sound good in a commercial or an ad or something like that. They sound good talking to investors, but the bottom line is you're probably doing something incremental. So for us, the way we measure things is just bottom line results. Because everything else, the problem with a process in and of itself versus, again, principles, is that the act of measuring things becomes the end, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we filed 350 patents this year. You know, we have 25 different startups. We have 62 different research and development programs. You know, we hired 52 more PhDs. None of those things gets to the bottom line, right? Because I could have thousands of patents like a lot of companies do, a lot of universities do, government institutions do, and not one of them was ever commercialized. They're just right in the proverbial heap or pile somewhere. And so we always tell folks, you know, what do you want to get out of this? And usually if it's the CEO, the board, the owner of the company, the investor, they're measuring it in only one way. Am I making money? Am I impacting companies or people's lives in such a way that that money I'm making will also persist for a long period of time? That's simple.
Yeah. Wow, the fog just lifted. How did that happen? Yeah, that makes perfect sense, right? So tell me about some of the manufacturing challenges you've addressed with these approaches, and what were your results?
Sure. I guess, you know, I'll start with a little one, and then I'll start with a big one. But the little one in some ways is simpler and illustrative. And this goes back over 20 years, back into the mid-90s, 96, 97. And we had just formed ABM Associates. I was working with my dad, and he got a call from a company called Diodario, and they make musical instrument strings. I believe they're the largest in the world. They're located down on Long Island, and they had essentially gotten a little form letter in the mail, and the little form letter was for the resins they use to make their strings. So musical instrument strings are a complex winding and held together with a resin. And as it turned out, you know, this I'm oversimplifying the story here, but the automotive industry used 99.9% of this stuff, decided they didn't need it, And so they got a form letter that said, you know, dear Diodario, we won't make this anymore. You're screwed.
Wow.
That's not fun. And obviously that wasn't the intent by the company making the stuff, right? But when we went in, and they basically just wanted something very straightforward. Can we get this? Can we get a new resin? Can we get something replaced? We got to get back online. And we only have 60, 90 days of stuff left or whatever. And we said, if you're going to put in all this effort to come up with something new, why don't we see where things went wrong, if you will, and what are the things, what are your fondest hopes and dreams for your company, right? What would be transformation? And they basically, you know, went through the laundry list. Well, first, we never want to be getting a form letter again for the resin we're buying. And we were like, well, what needs to be true for that to not happen? You need to own the formulation. You don't want to be dependent upon someone else's formulas, so we want to develop something for you. And so it's the reverse. You go to a company and have it made for you, right? That would solve one big issue, and you'd never encounter that challenge ever again, in all likelihood. The other thing was, well, what do you want your strings to do? And one of the things was is that, well, when they made strings way back when, you know, it was kind of a statistical hope what strings you got. So I'm not a music player by any stretch. But how the sound dampens, whether it dampens very quickly, whether it dampens very slowly, determines the kind of music you might play, right? A sharp note, I guess, versus a muddy note. And it was kind of random what they would get in the industry. So it wasn't just them, it was everyone. And we said, well, okay, so if you could maybe dampen in a controlled manner in 5 millisecond increments or something, that would be somewhat transformative to your industry and your manufacturing. And they're like, yeah, okay. And we said, all right, we'll have to see what needs to be true to do that. The next one was, could you make stuff faster? Everyone wants to make things faster, right? And so we said, okay, you know, how does that work now? And they were like, look, you know, occasionally we can get up to 3 times faster than we do, but that's actually pretty rare. And so then we just basically sat down and walked through what we like to call an adaptive innovation, the what must be trues. And as it turned out, when we started to break up those what must be trues, you know, it turned out that if you went out there and you looked for materials that were good at dampening sound and that you could actually control the dampening, notice I said nothing about music there. We were able to go out and find places where that was true. And it turned out it was things like on grain sacks for shipping to keep them from vibrating and sliding all over a rail car, right? Found these materials, how the products were designed, adapted them to what they were already doing for musical instrument strings, and all of a sudden they could basically tune in any dampening that they so desired on command. Simultaneously, through the cure mechanism we developed for them, we ended up in a situation where we were able to triple or more their production. All right, basically overnight. You know, we were able to switch to a cure mechanism that didn't rely on energy intensive systems and materials that could fail. And so we transformed basically their business, right? It only allowed them to become ever more dominant than they were before. If I fast forward to Cirrus or Bioformix, the company we sold a couple of years ago, which was probably the biggest effort we'd ever done, we actually attracted over $1 trillion in annual revenue, partners, investors, prospects and customers, from people like Apple to Procter & Gamble to General Motors, who was our largest strategic. There we were looking at bigger challenges, and the bigger challenges really was a test of adaptive innovation, was could we, if we had a big global challenge, could we actually solve it? And could we do it in a timely manner that was effective? And in this case, we looked at energy, and as it turned out, there was this big ball of fire called the sun, and one way or another, energy did get here to the earth, and one way or another, it could be harvested. So whether you burn things or had solar panels or wind or whatever, you know what? It really wasn't a crisis. It was just a matter of the form, and so we kind of walked away from that. But the other one that was interesting was essentially petrochemicals, and there was this fear that, you know, 10, 12 years ago still, that they might run out. I don't know that that's really the case anymore, because you can get them from plants and all kinds of other things. That's all changing. But a corollary to that was, could we eliminate energy between the two there, energy from manufacturing? Could I paint a car and not use heat? Could I do 3D printing and not use light, right? Because if I didn't have to use heat, if I didn't have to put in energy, I could probably do things much faster, much more efficiently. But even more importantly, I could use a much wider variety of materials. So if I use heat, I'm kind of limited, right? If the thing's going to melt, if the thing's going to burn, then heat isn't very good for you. As it turned out, we kind of prescribed all the what must be trues. And after about 3 years, we stumbled upon, pretty literally through some other work we were doing, a chemistry that had been looked at for 150 years, but couldn't be reduced to practice for any number of reasons. But that essentially the polymers, the materials could be formed ambiently at room temperature, kind of like super glue, cure nearly instantaneously. Ethylene malonates, they're called. And yet simultaneously, we could infinitely vary the properties, TGs of 300 degrees C to minus 70 C, so in other words, something really hard, powerful, strong, all the way down to something super rubbery and elastomeric, and do it on command and do it on demand. In the end, we were able to prescribe all the what must be trues to solve technical problems that hadn't been solved in 150 years. We're able to solve the basic tenets of them within about 6 months. All right, the initial target, we were able to solve in only about a month. And that was pretty staggering. And I got to say again, it wasn't because I'm brilliant or any of the group that we were working together that we were brilliant. My wife always tells me I'm an idiot, kind of clueless. But because we asked the right questions, framed in the right context, and then looked around for where things had been solved before. And we ended up with a technology that in the end, for someone like GM being pursued with BASF now, that's a public thing, we can paint a car standing still in less than 9 minutes with no heat, no solvent, no nothing.
Wow.
It fundamentally will change the way all things can be manufactured forever in ways that are far more transformative than simply something like additive manufacturing or different types of cure mechanisms. We fundamentally targeted and changed how things were made based upon what would be transformative. And that, to be honest with you, was very exciting, because it really proved out what we had spent 3 or 4 years before, kind of perfecting what adaptive innovation was, looking not only at what we were doing, because that was minor, but looking at what people like Thomas Edison had done, all the way through to Steve Jobs. What's common between those two folks is the simple fact that they looked at the business model, the ecosystem, the world around them, defined what needed to be true to achieve a transformation, and then they went around looking for it. So Edison didn't find 10 or invent 10,000 ways or whatever it is to make a light bulb. That isn't what he did at all. Instead, what Edison did was he had a list of specifications, not just technical, but from a business standpoint, from a labor standpoint, from an end user and consumer standpoint. And he tried 10,000 ways till he found the one that made the most sense, where he had existing labor pools, didn't have to train anyone, could use existing manufacturing methods, could provide a safe and easy-to-use set of materials, where he could transform light instead of having kerosene and Rockefeller and burning down buildings, on and on and on. And that's what made Edison brilliant. And when you fast forward to Jobs, you look at the iPod, all he was doing, well, he made a lot of money, was seeing just how little information could someone be provided with other than a few tactile buttons and run a device intuitively. And that eventually became things like the iPad and everything we have today, right? Really true brilliance from that standpoint. And he just looked around for everything that would allow him to meet those what must be truths. And so for us, those are some really key principles that end up surrounding innovation that I'm sure we can talk about later.
That's cool. The what must be true is, that's a really great line to keep in your head at all times, right? You have to figure that out and then move from there.
Well, it gets an abstraction, right? So most people look at how to innovate something. They look at their production line, they look at what they make, and they might even go to a little bit of open innovation and look around somewhere else. But the real key to transformational innovation is abstracting what it is you're trying to do. When you say in 1830, I just want to find a better way to get from point A to point B, I'd like it to be as fast as possible, as safe as possible, as this or that, and that's all you say, and you look in the sky and you see a bird flying with relative ease over every obstacle in its path, right? And then you look at the fastest birds and blah, 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 right? You look at sea life and which is the fastest fish. All of a sudden, you're finding things that have already solved it and trying to pull those elements together, right? You start to realize I need lightweight materials. I need a lightweight engine. I need lightweight power sources. And when you look at things that way, you'll find most of the greatest inventors of all time have all looked at the world in that simple way. And then what it allows them to do is, whether it's a plane, a car, a spaceship, whatever it is, it allows you to constantly be looking, persistently be looking for the things that make the ultimate what must be trues come true. So instead of saying I'm in the auto business, instead of saying I'm in the plane business, instead of saying I'm in the train or the horse business or the boat business, instead you say I'm in the transportation business, right? I'm here to get things from point A to point B. And maybe at some point you stumble upon something like a Star Trek transporter, right? Where I don't need anything at all other than to just, you know, zap you from here to there, right? And it just provides profound clarity to what it is that you're actually here to do. It provides profound clarity to your organization and all the people in it, because they know what are the four or five or six big things that we're all looking for. So whether you're a salesman, whether you're a chemist, whether you're a manufacturing engineer, whether you're in customer service, wherever it is you may be in finance, you're looking at the big numbers and saying, how can I make them go away? We work a lot with CFOs and financial people. And essentially when we walk in, they think, oh, we're technical folks. We want to see the lab and everything else. Instead, usually the first place we want to go is to talk to the finance guys, right? And we want to find out, what are your biggest costs of doing business? What are the biggest costs of your customers and their customers for doing business? And how can we make those go away, right? We'll then go to marketing and sales and go, what are the fondest hopes and dreams you're hearing from all of your customers, right? And then we'll start to talk about industries that may be analogous. And what we try in the end to get our clients to do is to spend their time at all levels of the organization persistently making contact with all areas of their ecosystem and like-minded ecosystems, so that they can find those what must be trues rather than having to develop them in a white space lab that costs $1 billion. Not that you don't need that, but you'll find more often than not that you don't need it as much as you thought you did, right?
Right, yeah.
And that's the link back to open innovation, because in open innovation, what you're saying is out of maybe 10 or 15 or 20 what must be trues, maybe 4 or 5 or 10 are very technical. Well, now you know exactly what you want to be looking for, whether it's in the literature, a university advertisement, or at yet2.com, right? Is I want a thing that does this. It goes up, it goes down, it does this, it does that. It makes it a lot easier to do that work rather than kind of like farming and hoping based on near-term goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so asking that question actually raises you up above the weeds, because I think a lot of companies, well, we all do, you get into the weeds and you cannot see what it is you're actually trying to do. But saying, yeah, I'm not in the train business, I'm in the transportation business, suddenly raises you above the weeds and you can get a really good look at the landscape. I love that.
Yeah, I think it's really very, very, it's one of the principles of is simply being deeply connected on a persistent every day, every minute, every hour basis to the world you exist in, your particular ecosystem, and then a bit beyond to analogous ecosystems, to always be looking for what it is you're doing. And anyone can do that. You don't need to, quote, be an innovator. You need to be good at finding stuff. And it's leadership's job to go out there and keep saying over and over, these are the 10 things. This is where we see the world going. This is what would be powerful and game-changing to us. And those are simpler messages than showing a 20-slide deck on strategy.
Yeah, yeah. So in manufacturing, it seems like it's better, faster, cheaper that people are going for, but also in manufacturing, it's waste reduction. So bring those two together for me and talk about how you approach that for a manufacturing company.
Yeah, I think for manufacturing companies, it's again, I go back to the principles of what does the consumer want, and what is even more importantly the customer's customer want, right? So if I'm making things that go into a car that get used by a consumer, I want to know, what does the consumer want in the car? All right. I still stick with that. Instead of faster, better, cheaper, what we try to say is instead substitute what I just talked about. Because, you know, faster is getting a little too abstract in a way, right? Better, what does better really kind of mean in a particular area? And cheaper, I would tend to say, you know, less costly, right? Which is kind of implied by the faster thing. I think what we would tend to kind of come together with is to say, in a manufacturing, people want to do things, they want to do it in a lot of ways for less money, they want to do it safely, they want to do it faster, okay? And what does that mean? It really translates into something different, which is, if I eliminate energy from manufacturing, which is a far simpler thing to say, it means I'm probably doing things at lower temperatures or ambiently, right? Mm-hmm. It means I can now use lots of other materials that, because they don't need to be heat resistant, they are going to tend by default to be less costly, right? Mm-hmm. That one simple thing in manufacturing is where we probably spend 85% of our time. And more often than not, when we're not using heat, because heat takes time to put into a thing, we usually end up with faster, right?
Okay, yeah.
And so what we try to do is while it's still abstract to say, let's eliminate energy from manufacturing, it's a subtle way of changing how your mind looks at the challenge, right? Mm-hmm. Because if I then go back to finances and we go look at the cost of an auto plant, in the end, the technology we developed through Cirrus Bioformics can eliminate over half the cost of building and operating an automotive assembly plant for folks like General Motors or BMW or Lexus, Toyota, whoever it is, right? Now we're starting with the painting of the cars thing, but the bottom line is by eliminating heat, I don't have to use metal as often, right? I can use a lot more plastics, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have to use solvents. I don't have to burn them off. I don't have to heat them up. I don't have to take the time to heat the components or heat the parts. If I don't have to heat the parts and cool them down, I eliminate a lot of stresses and strains. If I don't have to have all those extra stresses and strains, that means the material is much stronger than it was before. Now I can use less of those materials to lightweight the vehicles to get better gas mileage for the consumer. Mm-hmm. Kind of get that little stream of stuff, if you will.
Yeah.
And so eliminating energy from manufacturing. Eliminating solvents from manufacturing, okay? Finding faster methodologies for manufacturing. So in other words, not just faster, but faster methodologies. In other words, what are the five or six steps or methods that would be ideal if I could use them, right? So as opposed to welding, which takes time and energy, is there another method I could use to put a component together? Can I even avoid putting it together at all? 3D printing, making parts that otherwise would have to be made out of five or six parts. Mm-hmm. So these are all the ways we pull the stuff you said together, really by looking at it from a completely different vantage point, more abstracted and a little more very specific, taking the abstraction and kind of intersecting it with something more specific. Like if I look at all these different efforts broken apart, I'm really talking about eliminating energy from manufacturing. If I can do that, by going faster, by not using heat, all the things we just spoke of, I'm going to be in a far better place. And it's much easier for people from varied backgrounds to understand.
Yeah. So manufacturing currently is focused on Industry 4.0, artificial intelligence, things like blockchain and whatever. How does that all relate with what you see as the picture for manufacturing? Are they spending time on something that maybe they shouldn't be? Should they be rethinking their approach?
I look at it this way. I think this whole Industry 4.0 is wonderful, is great, but it's great at making the things that already exist more efficient. They're not going to uncover new chemistries or new ways to assemble, put things together, like I just said. They can augment it. They can make it more superior. If I can make these materials to do the things that we feel we can, make them super fast, no energy, stronger. I think all the digital stuff that's out there only can help make that happen faster, sooner, better, or make whatever has been developed become much more efficient, much more effective, if that makes any sense, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if I really can do, one of the things we're working on now is a way to make essentially nearly instantaneous 3D printing. We think we have a huge breakthrough there. We're very excited about it. All of a sudden, all the digital stuff you just spoke of becomes far more effective and far more applicable and realistic because it can have a material impact in a way that couldn't be before. It has no bounds, right? If I can basically make items as fast as any manufacturing technology already known or faster by another order of magnitude, well, now, you know what? I can do all that digital stuff and it'll carry over to its absolute full fruition. So in some ways, it's my belief that there's still a lot of untapped efficiency for existing technologies. And so 4.0 does great. Artificial intelligence, which to me is more high efficiency data gathering. If I have a cyborg, I'll start to think about artificial intelligence like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm not enthralled with that idea. Handling data, you know, I think that's really what AI is really about. It's just the wrong name for it. But I do think that there's a lot less folks spending time on new manufacturing methodologies that could be spending time there. And the efficiency just doesn't exist. And so I see working with startups, really smart folks, either on their own through universities or venture capital groups or otherwise, I think that needs to go up an ante. Because in the end, every device, every computing device we have, I don't care if you then run blockchain through it or AI through anything else, in the end, it's all dependent upon materials, right? Mm-hmm. And so quantum computing, all dependent upon materials. I don't believe we as a planet are spending enough time really asking the fundamental questions about what kind of materials, what kind of chemistry changes, physics changes can we take advantage of to get us to the next level. I think that's happening more slowly than I would personally like to see in manufacturing. I think it's happening faster in things like computing, right? And devices. I think the devices and the computing power is actually way ahead of where the material science is. And so I wish more folks went into STEM and went into material science. And I think we need to up the ante to encourage far more people, young people, to get educated in material science and far more educated in the connection of material science to manufacturing and all things digital as you've just described. I think those are subtle changes, not major changes, but they're important ones.
Right. So just to be clear, then what you see happening with manufacturing right now is more adaptive as opposed to transformational, no matter what name we're putting on it.
Yes. What I see is there are lots of things where a machine and a computing device or the two together can certainly be far faster, more accurate, et cetera, than a human being can be. That's wonderful. I think we move in that direction. But if when I walk into someone like a General Motors or an Audi or whoever and say, you know, I can paint that car in 9 minutes and cut half the cost of building and operating an automotive plant. And you know what? That saves them tens of billions of dollars, allows them to make far more cars and maybe half a quarter of the facilities they have today. That's transformative, right? That just changes. Everything else is about, can I do this 5% faster, 1% faster? That's not the same as making something 10 times faster, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's missed opportunities. I think it's almost like a foil that while all these things are great, I'm not saying they're not great, one can spend a huge amount of money and time on the digital world, on all of the aspects of it, and feel good that I'm doing something significant. But you're subtly blinded that if one person out there, just one company, figures out how to do something that essentially obliterates what you're able to do, by going 10 times faster, 10 times less cost, you're in a lot of trouble, right? I mean, that's not a good situation to find yourself in. And so all I'm saying is a lot more attention needs to be paid about the ecosystem you're in that's analogous to the ecosystem you're in, and to spend more time on the fundamental abstractions of what it is you do and the material science transformations that would allow you to manufacture things, you know, faster, better, more effectively, you know, as I said, with less energy, basically. I mean, that one focus basically changes how you look at the problem.
It sounds like you love your job. You're super passionate about it. You're making massive breakthroughs. Tell me a little bit about what the key moral driver is that you base your business choices on when you choose to work with a company.
You know, I guess there's two directions, and I'll start with something more personal, more simple. Is my wife is a three-time, three different cancer survivor. Just avoided a fourth one this year. So pre-cancer.
Wow.
It's gone on over our whole life that we've been together one way or another. Every 10 years or so, it seems like, you know, God pays us a visit. Wants to teach us something or remind us of something. But the bottom line is what motivates me is making her happy and making a difference in the world that's significant, that's real to people. Not the companies, but the people. Can I make people successful? If I can make a person successful, if my colleagues feel the exact same way, if we can make someone successful, their company will likely be successful, right? Mm-hmm. If we can make things difference in people's lives, things cost less, we can make people healthier, whatever it may be. Those are our own personal moral motivations. I like money and all. As we spoke before the podcast started, I'm a serious gardener. Probably if I spent any money on anything, might be a minefield robotic system for getting rid of deer, bunnies, and squirrels. So maybe that's the only thing where I might get really eccentric.
You have to get rid of them safely, though.
Yeah. But on the moral side, we look at a company. We want a company that is in of itself, has a culture that's extremely, I don't want to use the word loyal, but fair in its treatment of its employees, of its suppliers, of its customers and their customers, that has them in their mindset. Because you can't do this persistent ecosystem stuff if you have more of an adversarial attitude with any element of your ecosystem. And so we've had clients that we have said no to that are very big companies. And the no has been, look, we just don't think that the culture that you have in place as it stands at this moment in time will allow us to engage in a way that will deliver the transformation you're looking for. We have no problems working independently and come across things that might be useful to you, bringing them to you. That's great. But boy, we want to see a moral imperative. And the moral imperative has to be authentic. It can't be false. And I don't mean authentic in that, like, wow, we really believe. There's a lot of stuff going on that's far too political. That's far too pandering from a market standpoint. Social justice is one of the big terms today, right? It has to be, is what you're doing really consistent through your entire organization? If you say you want to help folks in the U.S. in social justice, but meanwhile you have child slave labor making your product in some other country, mm-hmm. that's wrong, right? If you're saying you want to help out with trash and ocean plastics and blah, 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 I comment about this a lot on LinkedIn, but you're actually shipping things to other countries, I'm sorry, that's not a good thing to be doing, right? On the flip side, if you say something like, well, you know, the United States and Europe don't recycle enough, they throw too much stuff out, they ship it to Asia, but as it turns out, you know, or the Southern Hemisphere, that the Southern Hemisphere generates 95% of its own trash that it pours into the ocean, and we're just a blip, right? These are all things that bother us, right? And not just from an authenticity standpoint or a moral standpoint, but it gets then back to the business model. They're not pursuing something that's realistic from a business standpoint, right? It's not real. So if it's not real, it's not likely to gain traction, if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And so we like things like eliminating energy from manufacturing, because if I can eliminate the energy, eliminate the waste, eliminate a lot of dangerous chemicals, for example, things like that, and it can be more automated, then I can manufacture it anywhere in the world and not have a negative impact on its environment, right? Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of things that motivate us in a client and the companies we work with. You've heard what I say is personally motivating, but the same kind of things are also personally motivating. We're very active in trying to develop right now whole classes of other of medical materials. One of the things that came out of Cirrus Bioformics is probably the most infinitely variable medical polymer platform known to exist again. And that's exciting, right? Because it can lead to saving hundreds of millions of lives long term, if not more. Right? Transform medicine. At least if you drop dead and I had no money and my garden got all eaten, at least I have that in my head that I and my colleagues and all the clients, the good folks we work with, are trying to do good. That was a long-winded answer. I apologize.
Yeah, no, that's great, because you're basically at the end of the day, if you're making a positive impact with the business that you're doing, then you're happy to be doing that business.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't charge the way other people charge. Our projects are not $500,000, $2 million projects just to go find out if someone wants double stuffed Oreos. Okay. We don't do things like that. This is immoral. Our projects start out in the thousands of tens of thousands because, you know what, we're really trying to find the what must be truths for all these big things. If we can earn a living while we're doing it and our collective colleagues at Elements can do that, that's great. If there's a big project and it's big because by necessity it needs lots of resources, like it needs it, that's fine. We don't walk around, and I write about this in one LinkedIn article, we're not the kind of saying, all right, hey, we got our consultants, we got our salespeople, can you generate $3 to $5 million a year in billings? That's not solving problems, right? It's about getting billings. Instead, what we like to do is tell folks, can you help change the way these things are made, the way medicine is delivered, the way a car is painted, the way shoes are made? Can we eliminate plastic waste or chemical waste or paper waste or whatever, right? Can we have a material impact? And those are the kind of folks we pull into our network, right? We don't ask them, can you just generate lots of money from people and suck it out of their company?
Hmm. Adam, you have offered a totally different perspective on the show. It's really been an eye-opener for me, and I hope it is for our listeners. Thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
It's been fascinating, and I hope if I give you a call again to have another chat, you'll be willing to join us.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. Thank you. Adam Milofsky is the managing director at Elements. He is based in Cincinnati, and that is our show for today. If you have a topic you'd like to discuss, please do get in touch at makeitrightpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube, and follow us from the various links on the podcast page at lucidi4.com. And please share this podcast with your friends. I'm Janet Eastman. Thanks very much for listening to the Make It Right podcast.